Good morning, everyone. Before we get going, I just wanted to say thank you so much to the committee for putting something like this together. Zan, Dan, Jake for hauling my wife and I around to some cool spots. Since we've been here, we've seen the haystack, hiked the cliff, gone out to your point, watched guys surfing a Point Break, stood and got our picture taken on shipwrecks, gone down cliffs, watched the huge jetty, looked across the Columbia River at the state of Washington. I mean, that's more than I would do in like a month when I was drinking. And I really appreciate you inviting my wife and I. We're 6 months pregnant. A lot of you have gotten to meet my lovely wife, Lauren. And all too often, you know, I have to kiss her goodbye late on a Thursday night, take two or three planes somewhere to come home at 10 o'clock at night on a Sunday, to kiss her goodnight, to get up and go to work on Monday, and we didn't have to do that this weekend. We got to enjoy you folks together, and that's my greatest joy in life, so thank you for including us. My sponsor would always remind me that you guys could do this without me. Matter of fact, you have been for 32 years, but I can't do this without you. And that's real important for me to remember. And with that said, I take off my watch here. My late friend who passed away last year, Jack Quarterman, always took off his watch. He thought it gave the newcomer hope that the meeting might come to an end. I'm not that deep. I think it gives them hope that one day they'll have a watch, because that's what I was thinking. And with that said, we'll get going. My name is Rich Bruckner. I'm an alcoholic. And from Ocean City, Maryland. I've had two sponsors so far in Alcoholics Anonymous. The first was a guy named Jim. Jim had a sponsor by the name of Clarence Snyder. He had a sponsor by the name of Dr. Bob Smith. I just tell you that because I just think it's important that we know what we're getting, who we're getting it from. Sometimes AA can be a little bit like that telephone game we play in third grade, where this gentleman starts off and whispers something to the lady to his left. You know, the napkins are red. And it goes all the way around the room. And we get to the back, and I say, "Hey, what was the message?" And they say, "Purple dragons fly at night." I mean, it doesn't even resemble, you know, how this thing started sometimes. So I like that we have, you know, this thing we do, passing it on. And a guy named, my job's pretty clear this morning. This guy, Ernie Kurtz, wrote a book called The Spirituality of Imperfection. It's one of my favorites. And in that book, he talks about one of the reasons that AA works so well is that we don't try to talk at anybody about this power that we refer to all the times through our steps. And it's real hard to talk at the power, to describe the power, to talk about the power. They try to do that in other organizations quite a bit, you know, on Sunday mornings sometimes. And this is a Sunday morning. And what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous, says Kurtz, is he says, we just tell our stories. And in those stories, we see this power work. So I'm going to try to keep up my end of that bargain and just tell you all my story, and I'd like you to keep up your end of the bargain, which is, you know, listen to where that power might be working. And when I say that, at some point, I saw a bunch of hands, you know, of those new folks, as I told you my name. I was separated from alcohol on August the 30th of 04. I didn't quit drinking. I didn't put the plug in the jug. I didn't make a decision to come to you folks. All of those would be so arrogant. And it would also make me not one of you, because that would imply that I somehow have power, choice, and control over whether or not I drink. And that was not my plan. August 29th, I was drunk as a monkey. And August 30th, I didn't have to take a drink all day. And there's nowhere in our book that says how to make that happen. You know, we don't have any plan in any part of Alcoholics Anonymous that says, you know, how to not drink for that first day. That's it, man. That's the gift, right? And all I got to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, you guys spent 164 pages telling me how to accept it, how to protect it, how to respect it, and how to live sober. You know, that's what we do. But that first day, what a miracle. You know, that's the day. And I don't have an explanation for that other than this power that you all have started to teach me about. And I'm going to refer to it, and if it accidentally slips out of my mouth, God, right? I saw all those new hands go up. I want to tell you, don't let that You know, whatever, when I just say that word, that three-letter word, whatever pops in your head when I say that, that's what I'm talking about. Words sometimes tend to separate us a little bit. Spirituality tends us to bring us together. And that's what I hope happens here this morning. I hope nothing I say, just because I am bound by our language, separates us. As a matter of fact, there was a guy, when I was new in sobriety, he asked me, you know, what do you think about this whole God business? And I went on explaining to him, I can't remember when I learned how to surf. That's how long I've been surfing. And I started explaining to him, well, I know that there's some kind of power, you know, because what waves are is waves are lines of energy that travel thousands of miles across an ocean. And a wave breaks when it hits half the depth of the size of a wave. So an 8-foot wave will break when it hits 4 feet of water or reef. And if the bottom of that, you know, the reef or the sand is configured in a certain configuration, the wave breaks in a certain direction. But then on top of that, the wind has to be coming in another direction off the shore that holds the wave up and blah, blah, blah. And if all this happens at one time, I get a good day surfing and I could never make all that happen. I've also noticed, you know, back where I live, we have seasons, you know, that in the fall, these leaves, you know, I'm explaining to this guy, he's 20-some years sober, and I'm explaining to him, you know, these leaves, they in the fall, they I don't know if they send out a leaf memo, but they all seem to know how to fall off the trees at just the right time, and in the spring, you know, maybe another memo goes out, but they all seem to, like, start bunting and come out, and I don't know how all, you know, I would concede that there's got to be something that makes all of this happen, and he goes, whoa, Rich. You just wasted 25 minutes of our meeting. We only get an hour. We have a word. It's got three letters. It's real short. God. When you say that, it's much shorter. You don't waste as much time, and we all know what you're talking about. So if I say that little word, it's in the interest of time, and that's what I'm getting at. And I'm referring to that thing that we're certainly surrounded by here in Seaside, Oregon. When we take that deep breath of this misty salt air and we feel it around us and in us, that's what I'm talking about. And what makes me one of you is not what alcohol does to me, it's what it does for me. And that's real important. Because what I'm going to tell you about real quickly is my first drink. And if anybody here can remember that, that's not good news if you're trying to figure out whether or not you're alcoholic. Because I cannot tell you about my first Coca-Cola, my first glass of milk, my first orange juice. I have no recollection. But many of us, and certainly me, I can report with detail on my first drink. So right away, that tells you that my relationship with this thing called alcohol is fundamentally different than any other beverage. And why that is because of what it does for me, not what it does to me. Alcohol does to the human body the same thing. It's a poison. It's a depressant. You put enough alcohol in a non-alcoholic, they'll eventually get sick and throw up. Doesn't make them alcoholic. That's the effect of alcohol on the human body. You put enough alcohol in a non-alcoholic, put them behind the wheel of a car for enough times, they'll get a DUI or two or three. Does not make them alcoholic. That's what happens when you drink enough and drive enough. If you put enough alcohol in a non-alcoholic for a long enough period of time and stop abruptly, they'll shake and sweat and twitch and go through the early DTs. Does not make them an alcoholic. That's just the effect of alcohol on the human body. That is not what makes me one of you. But boy, I'm willing, the thing that does, I'm willing to let it do an awful lot to me in exchange for what it does for me. What happened on this day at this school that I went to, back in Baltimore, Maryland, growing up, they had a rule back there. I don't know if they have it here. Like the older kids sit in the back of the school bus and the younger. It's like a social hierarchy right from the beginning, you know. And I had no idea that what was happening was that I was starting to feel consciously aware or separated from you. There's a guy, I hate to use the term because I don't even know that there is such a thing. It just sounds funny, but an enlightened alcoholic, you know, those words don't go very well together. But this guy, Chuck Chamberlain, seems to have gotten pretty close. In this book that, you know, came from a talk, he says that there's really only one problem that encompasses all other problems, and that's this thing called conscious separation. And there's only one solution that encompasses all other solutions, and that's this conscious contact. So I had no idea on that school bus I was beginning my conscious separation. And there was a kid on that bus, his name was Reed. I don't know if y'all do this in the, you know, Oregon. But Reed's job, the school, I believe, I've never checked on this, but I think they assigned Reed to beat me up every day for something. And he would figure out a different reason. But on this particular day, some of the older kids who I always wanted to hang out with, they said, do you want to skip last period and do some drinking? I'd never skipped any class, I'd never done any drinking, and out of my mouth came, you bet. And I wish I had something a little tougher to report to you guys, because this is kind of wimpy. But again, I know that what makes me one of you is not what I drink, how often I drink, what flavor it is, none of that. It's just what it does for me. They said, what do you drink? And I said, bourbon. And I don't know where that came from, and that would have been awesome if we had bourbon, but we didn't. We had peach schnapps, and that's wimpy. And we start passing this peach schnapps around, and the first thing I notice as I'm drinking this with these fellas is I'm kind of standing shoulder to shoulder with them, that they're as lucky to be hanging with me as I am with them, and I've never felt like that. And then I went into the restroom, and at that school, it was, you know, for kids, on the door of the restroom, it said boys. And that kind of struck me as funny, because for the first time, I sort of felt like a man, you know. And I go into the boys' room feeling like a man, and the next thing that crosses my mind, there's this girl on the school bus, and her name's Nikki, and I really like Nikki. Nikki looks a lot like a lot of you women here this week. I mean, she's put together, looks nice, dignity, shoulders back, and I mean, and I don't know how to, Nikki is something, and I don't know how to talk to her, I don't know how to tell her that, I don't know how to ask her out, I got nothing. But on this day, I'm in the boys' room feeling like a man with this peach schnapps in me, the thought comes across my head, I mean, I intuitively know how to handle this situation that's been baffling me for years, and I come out of that bathroom, you know, feeling like a man, I get on that school bus, I'm going to the back of the bus, because I'm going to sit next to Nikki, Reed gets up out of his seat to give me my daily beating, and as he's getting to his feet, I clock him with everything I got in me. Reed goes down and out, and the whole school bus gets really, really quiet. And I sit down next to Nikki, and I'm looking at Nikki, and Nikki's looking at me, and I'm looking at Nikki. And this feeling comes over me, man, that there is not a peep on that bus. And it was like, some of y'all know this. I mean, it was like, whew, long overdue respect. You know, like, finally, you all know who I... And then we got to Nikki's bus stop, and she leaned over before she got off the bus, and she gave me this little kiss that some of you guys will remember. I mean, this thing, it was half on my lips and half on my cheek, and I felt it in my toes. It was unlike my mother and my aunt had ever kissed me. I mean, and she got off her stop, and I went into my house, and my parents, I come from good stock, man. Nobody in my family drinks. No grandparents, no aunts, no uncles, no... I have one little sister, 3 years younger. Nobody in my family ever has had a drink of alcohol except for me. So I know I've heard some genetic theories of alcoholism. That's cool. I don't know. My sponsors tell me, he said, I think you're alcoholic because you drank too much, and I've just gone with that. And if you're new, don't waste too much time on trying to figure that out. We've already heard about that this weekend, but I like telling this story. Maybe I just like the way I tell it. Trying to figure out why we're alcoholic. Here's why it's such a waste. It's like a guy whose house is on fire, right? The house is burning to the ground. The fire department's there, the hook and ladder trucks, all my neighbors are there. That's you guys. You fed that fire hose all the way through the crowd. I mean, the house is burning to the ground. It's critical. You know, top floors getting ready to collapse in. I'm standing up front with the fire hose. You all are screaming at me, Rich, shoot the hose. Shoot the hose. Would you please just shoot the hose? And I'm standing up front going, wait a second. We got to figure out how this fire started first. I mean, who cares how the fire started? We've got everything you need right here to put it out. So please don't waste as much time as I did trying to figure out whether you are or whether you're not. Anyways, I end up sick all night long in that house. I mean, those people, gosh, my mother and father, good morals, integrity, values in that house. And they leave me in there to teach me a lesson. You know, they're going to teach me. And I'm curled up around that toilet. I wake up. I'm sick as a dog. Been throwing up all night. Peach schnapps is much better, you know, one way than the other. And my neck's all kinked up around the toilet. That, you know, the floor's on you. And I was grounded forever. That's a big deal in eighth grade. I mean, like, seventh, eighth grade, you know, that's like life sentence, right, without parole. And the next thought that went through my head as I kind of am gaining some consciousness, like, wow, I have never felt this bad. Sick as a dog. I'm grounded forever. Are you ever going to do any more of that drinking? You bet. You bet. I mean, sick as a dog and grounded forever? What a small price to pay for what I had going on that school bus. And I had no idea that in that instant, something inside me was inwardly rearranged that was just like Bill Wilson describes in his story, that this thing had been set in motion much like a boomerang that was going to one day turn in flight and come back and nearly shred me to ribbons. And little by slowly, one drink at a time, I was going to give away every bit of morality, every bit of integrity, every bit of decency that that family and all the people in my life had given me. And it was going to happen so slowly that I didn't even know it was happening. And our book talks about that too, doesn't it? Says that often by the time the alcoholic, that's me, you know, realizes that it's a problem, it's too late. I've slipped past, you know, wasn't paying attention. I just slipped past human aid. Something more was going to be required. I ended up, this power, this force for good, this good orderly direction, this God thing, it gives each of us some special talents and abilities, and I didn't work for them. I don't deserve them. One of the things that happens is if I read something, I remember where it was, I could parrot it back at you, and I can tell you what page it is and where it is. That's very good for testing well and doing well in school. It's absolutely useless for life and learning values and hard work and trying none of that. But because of that, I did very well in school, and I got to go on a scholarship out to this nice Jesuit college in San Diego, University of San Diego, to play soccer. And I quickly fall in with some other guys. If you're on scholarship, that means you're poor, by the way. You know, and they're driving. They got palm trees. I mean, it looks like Beverly Hills 90210. They got the red BMWs. The girls are dating the guys that got those. And you know, and I don't have a car. I got nothing. I'm there on scholarship. There's a couple other guys on the soccer team, four of them. They're there on scholarship. They're from 20 miles away, Tijuana, Mexico. And we become quick friends because there's a spiritual principle called water seeks its own level. And the neat thing about spiritual principles is you don't have to agree with them. You don't have to think they're right or wrong. You're nothing. They just are. It's sort of like gravity. You know, you could push me off the roof and I can argue with you all the way down how I don't believe in gravity. And I'm going to hit just as hard. But no matter where I go, I'm drawn to me. And I attract me. Because I am me. And of course, I don't know that that's what's happening. And I fall in quickly with these guys. And these guys got lots of cousins. Each of them had like 50 cousins just across the border. And these guys, they know how to get this green stuff that the rich kids like smoking. So we get a little bit of that going. And I got two soccer practices a day, one in the morning and one at night. And I got these Jesuit classes. And I have this lady, she's called an academic advisor. I mean, that sounds pretty neutral, doesn't it? Pretty harmless, academic advisor. And her only job is to try to help me pick classes that maybe I'll graduate in 4 years. But I don't see it that way. That's another defining characteristic of an alcoholic of my variety. As I've looked back through these inventories, there have been many people in my life that have tried to help me, tried to point me in the right direction, give me a friendly nudge in the right direction. I don't see it like that. An alcoholic of my variety, anybody that's trying to help me, I think you're trying to hurt me. You're trying to hold me down. You're trying to tell me how to live my life and back off. Back off. And I don't know what that is, but there's been many people that have tried to help me, and I just think you're trying to hurt me. She says they have some idea about getting an office of alcohol and drug education. It's a peer counseling office that they want to get started to provide alcohol and drug counseling for the students, and they want it to be a peer counseling program. And, you know, she says, if you want to graduate and go anywhere in life, you need to get some things on your resume other than, like, decent soccer player. She's like, that's not going to get you real far. Anyways, they say, you know what, Rich, we want to send you. We want to get you certified as an alcohol and drug counselor. You're going to be the founding father of the Office of Alcohol and Drug Education. This is going to look really good on a resume. And I don't know about you guys, but I know about looking good on paper. I mean, that's important for an alcoholic, right? Got to get it all together, look good. And they do that. You know, and I can tell you, I'm not going to because I'll bore you, and it's useless in alcoholics. I can tell you more about the disease of alcoholism than you care to hear. You know, the Jelinek curve and where you are and blah, 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 right? I know all about it while I'm dying from it. That's an interesting condition. And now my day is getting full because now I have the morning soccer practice, the Jesuit classes. I got to drink a little bit, you know, right after that afternoon soccer practice. Have a little dinner. I got to do some shrink wrapping of a couple pounds of this green stuff to get that mailed back east and to get the money coming in. And now I got office hours at night from 7 to 10 to counsel you pathetic people with your alcohol problem. And, and I'm doling out the AA schedules and listening to you. And by the way, when we're done with this little talk, if any of you need to just take the edge off, come see me in my dorm room. I'll get you squared away. And then I got to go back to my room and drink enough that I can fall asleep. And if any of you ask me about my drinking, I tell you, I got a lot going on. I'm busy. You know, if your life was like my life, you'd need to drink a little bit to fall asleep too. And it turns out that there's another... It's a principle, really. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, there's new people that are wondering, I just wanted to know how you folks slept. All I wanted was a good night's sleep without alcohol in my system. How do y'all sleep? And I was sweating and tossing, turning that pillow over. And if you're going through that and you're counting days or months, man, I know what you are going through. I would flip that pillow over. And I'm not talking about sweating through the pillowcase. I'm talking about sweating through the pillow. You know, and you got to go to Walmart and get a new $4 pillow so you could ruin it with that big yellow circle. And, you know, and all the while knowing that if I had just three or four good ones, I could get a good night's sleep. And I'd ask some of the old dogs in AA, you know, hey, how do you all sleep? And they're, well, kid... You know, I'm like, what do you guys take? What's the AA, like, over-the-counter approved sleeping pill? Like, what do you do? Well, kid, a clear conscience makes for a soft pillow. We take the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and I had no idea that what was going on was that my conscience was anything but clean. And the book says that the alcoholic often lives a double life. I could tell you, if I just had two going, that would have been great. I had... Oh, if any two people in my life would have talked at the same time, there would have been trouble. If my little sister would have talked to my mother about the stories I'd been telling each of them, trouble. If my mother had talked to my teachers, trouble. If my teachers had talked to my soccer coach, trouble. If my coach, you know, had talked to my trouble. If my girlfriend had talked to my other girlfriend, big trouble. Just trouble. And it's a lot of energy to keep all these people separate. And you got to drink. You got to drink. It's a lot. And that's what's going on with me. By my senior year, I'd switched from the bringing across the green stuff to the white stuff. It was more money. By my senior year, I had purchased my first house in La Jolla, California, one of the nicest neighborhoods and one of the nicest communities in the world. It was 423 Nautilus Street. It's the third house on the right at Wind and Sea Beach. I don't surf anymore, but I live right next to one of the best surfing spots in the world. Because when I drink, and I do little else. All the surfboards had gone. Everything must go when I start drinking. Hobbies, values, fun, gone. A little bit at a time. Alcohol doesn't take it all at once. We heard that. It takes it very slowly, so I don't even know that it's going. And when I look back, I now say took, and what really happened was I gave. I surrendered each of these things to that king alcohol we talked about. I was dating, I'm driving a silver BMW at that point. I got the car, I got the house, silver BMW convertible. It had a number on the back of that BMW that let you know that they don't even make this model in the United States. It's one of the European ones that I had to have shipped here, you know, on a boat to let you know that I'm that important. Bill Wilson says three little words, I had arrived. And I was dating the most beautiful woman in that college. At least that's what you guys said, so I dated her. I still don't know if I liked her. And we're having cereal that morning, and boom, 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 boom. Every single door and window in that house came in, and off I went. Plastic zip ties, they're worse than the handcuffs for anybody that's had them. And they took me off to the Metropolitan Correction Center, which is a federal penitentiary in downtown San Diego. The San Diego Union Tribune, Los Angeles Times headline said, Jesuit student, 27 kilos of cocaine. And I'd been arrested a lot to that point, but nothing serious. I don't want anybody to think I was any type of, you know, tough guy. I wasn't. I was an idiot. I mean, if you pulled my NCIC, like your criminal background, it would, you know, be like drunk in public, you know, failure to obey a lawful command, right? Y'all know that one. And there's two types of people. A lot of this stuff on there was nonsense, and you guys, I'm sure, will agree with me. It's the police and these prosecutor type people. They take they're so serious. And what happens is we get arguing about like a drink at the bar and we get pushing each other. You know what they call that on my rap sheet? Second degree assault. I mean, like that sounds serious. And, you know, so it's all full of stuff like this. And there's these federal sentencing guidelines that they use in this federal system. And I've never been anywhere like this. And I have no idea when you come from a nice family how you end up in a federal penitentiary. And they look and they go down the side, and I'd have 35 of these little stupid things, but they don't feel like that. And they go down here, and then they come over to the amount of drugs there are, and they go down. And it said that I was looking at 46 to 60 years is the range that the judge had to sentence me. And I'm going, holy cow. And the United States attorney stood up and he said, if Mr. Bruckner's given any bond whatsoever, he'll flee and live a happy and successful life in Mexico. Those words hit me right here. That was the first thing that I call a direct hit. All those people try to help me, those are near misses. That stuff doesn't faze an alcoholic of my variety. You know, when the doctor says your liver's acting up, taper it all, you know, you can't drink anymore. What's he know? That goes right by me. In high school, I rolled a CJ7 Jeep with no doors, no roof. Five of my friends in there. The thing rolled three times. We all fell out in the cornfield, broke arms, legs. Nobody was seriously hurt. You think that captures my attention? Heck no. You know what I think? I walk away. I go, did you all see that? That was some good drunk driving right there. I mean, that was NASCAR type stuff, you know. These are the things that might capture the attention of, you know, a hard or a heavy drinker. But me, no, sir, right past. And here I am. Now I'm in this place, and he's talking about no bond, happy and successful life. I hadn't had a happy and successful life in Baltimore. I hadn't had a happy and successful life at my parents' beach place in Ocean City. I hadn't had a happy and successful life in San Diego. I hadn't had a happy and successful life when I got a house in La Jolla. Happy and successful life in Mexico with these people looking to kill me. What is this guy talking about? You know, but judges buy that kind of stuff. So they hold me without any bond. And not that there was anybody to post bond at that point, because I had isolated every single family member. An alcoholic of my variety, God bless you if you love me or you're related to me, because I will suck you dry. The more you love me, the more I take from you. The more you love me, the more I bleed you dry. Because you know why? You want to believe I'm going to get better. You want to believe it's going to be different this time, and that's what I'm telling you. And down goes the ship, you know. And some of these, they were just done. My little sister hadn't spoken to me in a long time by this point. And I'm sitting in there, and I was in there almost 9 months. And just before trial, it was a few days before trial, it turned out that the DEA had some problems with the search warrant. You know, something was messed up with the way they wrote it, and they had to throw all of the cocaine they found out for trial, so they couldn't use it. There was no trial. The case was dismissed, and I walked out. And I would love to tell you that I walked out a free man, but anybody sitting in this room, you know, when you get out of penitentiary, you're thirsty. And that started a period of time where I couldn't stay where I was for a whole lot of reasons. There's people looking for me. I couldn't go back east because I had ruined every relationship, shamed that wonderful family. And that started a period where I had absolutely surrendered to alcohol. I started bouncing around the country. If you'd asked me, I'd have told you I was an alcoholic. I'm the guy that puts a $20 tip on the bar when I walk in. I say, this is your tip. I drink double bourbons, and every time I got to ask you to fill it up, you lose a dollar. I'm an alcoholic. Keep it full. I knew what I was, and I thought that that's just what happens, is you just drink until you eventually die. And I start going from Sun Valley, Idaho, to Ketchum, to Steamboat, Colorado, Utah, Jackson, Wyoming. And I'm a midnight mover, you know, because when I drink, I tend to do things, you know, that I'm not real stationary, and nothing I do is decent. I've never come out of a blackout and had any friends say, you know, that was wonderful what you were doing last night. You went up to the Super Fresh and you were helping little old ladies push out their groceries and you were loading their cars. You were helping them across the streets. We've never seen anything like it. You know, I don't do stuff like that. I do stuff that ends up in a warrant. And when there's a warrant, I'm a coward. I run. You know, I run. And little things become big things. Driver's license. By the time I got to you folks, I had warrants in three states. I didn't have a driver's license, nothing was in my name. The federal government taking everything, no bank accounts. I wasn't allowed to have a bank account because that thing called check systems. And you guys right away impressed me, because people would talk about, you know, in AA, that's a big deal. People, that guy in the meeting or gal that goes, you know, I have a valid driver's license with my own name on it, a registration card that matches, and insurance all in my name. And I'd hit my sponsor and I'd go, Did you hear that? She's got the trifecta. That's what I'd call it. I mean, it was like mind-blowing to me that anybody could have all three of those things at the same time, in the same state, in your real name. Because I have some other things going, but not that. Meanwhile, while this is going on, when I get a warrant, you know, I move at midnight, which means you got to leave a lot of stuff behind. And when you move at night, you know, everything you have gets less and less and less. And I can tell you now that if I had every single television set that I've left behind, I'd have my own Best Buy store. I can feel, you know. But when you got to go, you got to go. And meanwhile, the delusion of this thing is, if I met any of you women that are here, you know, this weekend, looking good at the bar, you're sitting next to me, and I buy you a drink with money that's probably not mine, and you go, so, what's your story, Rich? I go, I'm traveling, babe, traveling. Like I'm some type of romantic sojourner across our great land, you know? And the truth is, I'm trying to stay one step ahead, you know, until eventually I run out and I end up where all tough guy, big shot, wannabe drug dealers end up when everything runs out. And that's, you know, back on my mom's couch in Ocean City, Maryland. And obviously, this is a good view from here because I'm seeing a lot of laughing and nodding, and that means you might have started this journey on mom's couch, which is a great place for this thing to begin. And moms only have one rule when you're at mom's couch. You could stay here as long as you want, as long as... As long as you don't drink. Stay here as long as you want. And I was never, ever, ever going to drink again. I couldn't even believe it that this woman took me back one more time. And I start popping in and out of your meetings, and I'm going to like 90 meetings in a week. There's different kinds of meetings in Ocean City, Maryland. There's our schedule. You know, there's some meetings that I come into, and right off the bat, you see a book up front like this. And if I walk into one of those, I try to get out very quickly. There's other ones where they talk about steps and traditions, and so I try to get out. I like the ones, and we got a lot of them in my area. You know, we're very fortunate for a sick dude like me, because water seeks its own level. That means like attracts like, right? Sick attracts sick. And I go in, like Monday, I'll just go through a couple days of the AA schedule in my area. It says Monday, 8 p.m., open discussion, open discussion, open discussion, open discussion, open discussion, big book study. Tuesday night, open discussion, open discussion, open discussion, open discussion, speaker meeting. Wednesday night, open discussion, right? And I like those kind because there's, well, because I do. And that's what I'm drawn to, right? So I go in, there's different topics, you know, and I can't figure out why I'm not getting sober. You know, I go into the discussion, they go, does anybody have a topic? And, you know, Thelma raises her hand, like, yes, Thelma. And Thelma says, you know, I want to talk a little bit tonight about my cat, Fluffy. I've had Fluffy for 14 years, and he just passed, and Fluffy was a good cat. I always fed Fluffy the best of foods, and I would make Fluffy his own little... And she goes for about 15, 20 minutes, and then she calls on Gertie, and Gertie talks about her little... You know, she had a Yorkshire Terrier, it turns out. And she tells us all about this Yorkshire Terrier, and then she passes the meeting on to her friend, who it turns out, of all things, she had a parakeet. And she'll tell us about this parakeet. And all these wonderful pet owners are telling these stories of pets cared for and lost. And I'm just sitting here like, wow. And then I leave the hours up, because they're only an hour, and I leave. And I leave an hour meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous knowing no more about recovery from the deadly disease of alcoholism than when I got there. You know, and... But I'm drawn to this because I don't know any better. You know, I'm new. And then I come in, of course, my favorite meeting topic, you know, of all times of the open discussion. Does anybody have a topic? You know, and John raises his hand. And they do that, you know, with like determination. And it turns out that, you know, John says, this is my favorite topic. She left me again. Right? She left me again. And then he shares about this relationship gone bad. And then we go around the room, and this is incredible to me. We share our sage alcoholic knowledge of relationships with one another. And this goes on for an hour, you know, and he calls on Bob, who's on his sixth wife. And then he calls on Melissa. Melissa has been married to the same guy four times. Married, divorced, married, divorced, married, divorced, married, divorced. You know, but she's got some input. And here we go, and we're going around the room. And an hour goes by, and I come out of the room, you know, and I don't know anything more about recovery from the deadly disease of alcoholism than I did 60 minutes prior. Perhaps I'm a better dater, but I'm dying. There's this one woman, Janine. She bothers me more than anybody. Janine, she's like 18 years sober when I met her. Janine drives me crazy. If I see her and I have time, I get to another meeting. Janine looks like, well, she looks like a lot of you. You know, she's one of those people that are like sober and clearly happy about it, you know, which I don't relate to. I'm not even sure you got what I got. If you're happy and sober at the same time in the same sentence, you know, you might have something different than what I got. Because if you're like me and you stop drinking, the walls start closing in. I start looking at the mail, and all those bills that I've been throwing away are piling up. My guts are getting tighter, and things are just, and it starts to bother me that my mother can't look me in the eye or talk to me. And it bothers me that my little sister hadn't spoken. spoken to me in 6.5 years. And all this only happened when I'm sober, and it's, ugh. And Janine and her deal, man, it's different. She's 18 years sober. She walks in every meeting. She's carrying the book. That bothers me. I mean, 18 years sober, haven't you read it yet? And she's got that goofy smile. And here's the big thing. She doesn't call her sponsees. She doesn't call them pigeons. She calls them duckies. You know, and there's like six of them. They follow her everywhere. And there's this little trail. And it's enough. I'm sorry to tell you that right after breakfast. You probably felt it come up a little bit. I mean, it's disgusting. Duckies. Knock it off. And all I want to do, I'm the guy, I'm in the way back usually, you know, I got my collar up at that point, I wore a hat because I didn't know about wearing a hat inside, and, you know, it was disrespectful, and I got the hat down and arms crossed and, you know, in the back, and all I'm thinking is I'm going to knock that smile off her face. And pretty much anybody's smile, I just want to knock it off their face. And I'm bouncing in and out and in and out and in and out and in and out and in and out. And I make your coffee. I set up your literature tables. I'll do anything you tell me to do, unless it's got anything to do with that book or, you know, steps or any of that. I mean, I am a service guy. I'm a meeting maker, you know, and, you know, meeting makers make it. And I can't figure out what's going on because I am certainly not making it. And I eventually end up performing a residential burglary on my mother at 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm drinking. I need more. I run out of what I had. She has a restraining order at that point. I'm not allowed on the 100 yards of the property or in her house. My aunt and uncle had one to keep me away from their 3 daughters, who are my goddaughters. Not because I do anything dangerous or violent. It's because I break their heart time and time again. I show up at Thanksgiving, and I promise what I'm going to bring them for Christmas, and then I don't show up, and those little girls cry year after year. I couldn't be near them. I break into my mom's house because that's, you know, what cowards do. I'm not gonna rob you. You look like you might hurt me. You know, so I break into my mom's house. She sleeps with the door deadbolted. Her little purse she sleeps with under her bed in her bedroom with a restraining order. All of those things. So that tells you a little bit about the previous nature of our relationship. I'm coming across the bedroom floor on my stomach at 3 a.m. doing my best commando crawl. And I'm reaching under the bed for her purse, and her eyes come off the side of the bed, and she catches me square in the eyes, and she said, "Rich, take it. Would you just take it?" And that was another one of those direct hits, because there's some of you that are my friends and I surf with or swim with or walk around the halls. You know, I got a scar here. I've been stabbed in Panama with a deal going bad. I got a little M branded in my shoulder by those guys in Mexico to remind me who owns me and who I work for forever. You know, I've been beat up, I've been locked up. You could do all of that, but don't you give up on me, Mom. Don't you give up. That's a direct hit. I don't know how to deal with that. And I take that purse and I stay drunk as long as I can, and I eventually end up back with you folks because I can't stay away from you and I can't stay with you. And I make it to 36 days without a drink, and then I reach that place that's the reason we're here this weekend. And it's a spectacular day, maybe better than the other day, that day where that power first brought me to you on August 30th, that first day without drinking, that was a wonderful day. But at 36 days without so much as a drink and a million meetings under my belt, I knew in the core of my being that I couldn't take so much as one more drink and I couldn't live one more day without a drink. We call that the jumping off place. And I did what cowards do. And I got to tell you why I decided that, I guess. I would read your steps, and I knew just about enough about your program to be really dangerous to myself and anyone that might listen. And I would just read them up on the wall with no sponsor, no interpreter, no guide, no teacher, you know, nothing, me. And it was mostly that fourth and fifth step. I'd read it and made this search. You feel, write this down, and you're all very big. We've heard all weekend long, you people are very big on writing things down. And when you're in my line of work, I mean, that is the first rule of business. You don't write anything down. It's called a paper trail. I just got out of the federal penitentiary. I'm not going back. The IRS is looking for me. I got warrants in 3 states, and you want me to write it all down? No. You know, and there's only one problem with not doing that. I'm dying. So at 36 days, I'd been to the doctor. My liver was biopsied. They told me that I couldn't take any Tylenol for a year. My liver might rebuild. That biopsy feels good, if anybody's had that, where they put that tube between the rib cage and pull out a chunk of the liver. And that's not normal at 29, probably. But I, you know, that went right past. And I take all the Tylenol I can get a hold of, everything else in the medical cabinet. What happens next is I have no explanation for. My body collapses, and this is all reported to me. I fall down. I live in a crappy apartment because that's where drunks live. I fall. I crash into the refrigerator. The refrigerator hits the wall. Next door to me, because it's a crappy apartment, the walls are thin. There's a lady next door. It's a Tuesday. She hasn't missed a day of work in 7.5 years, but she did this day. She was homesick. She heard boom into the wall. It scared the daylights out of that little lady that lives next door. She ran outside, looked through the front thing, saw feet, called an ambulance, 911. I wake up in the same hospital that I'd been in 4 times prior in a year past. I wake up, I'm in a paper gown. My things are beeping. You know, there's paper hospital gowns that tie into, they're sexy. Your butt hangs out. And things are beeping. I clear my eyes. I can't even believe it. You know, I can't even die right. You know, what a loser. Y'all know who's at the foot of the bed. Janine with the duckies. Now, I'm not sure if there's a place called Alcoholic Hell or not, but if there is, I was pretty sure that I was there. And Janine did not speak to me that day, but she did talk to the duckies. And she looked at them, and here's what she said: girls, I want you to take a good look. This is what happens to an alcoholic that refuses to take our steps. Let's go, girls. And that was it. That was it. That snapped that last little pride, ego, whatever, me, whatever name you like to put on it. That's where the magic happened. And when I got to reading Bill's story, I got to tell you, I was a little bit jealous. That cool breeze, the bright light that came upon Bill, and I got Janine and the duckies. Are you kidding me? Like, but what I now know is that it was Janine was every bit as significant as that cool breeze and that bright light, because the next thought that came across my mind, I've never had a thought like it before and never one since, and that was, if I get out of here, if I get out of this hospital, I'm going to find one of those old guys with that book in their hand and that smile on their face, and I'm going to do everything they say to do. That was it. In that singular thought that I don't know where it came from, my life changed. And that man began walking me through your program and explaining to me this stuff, that first step, that I'm a guy that's got less power. He said, powerless. Would you agree, Smarty? He loved calling me that because I thought I was. You know, hey, Smarty, do you think powerless could mean that you have less power? Yes, Jim. Yes. Less power than what? You know, the second part, he goes, can you think, hey, Smarty, stay with me. Is there any decision in your life, let's just try to think of one, that you've made over and over and over and over again? Can you think any of those? Yes, Jim. That I'm never, ever, ever going to take another drink. How you doing managing that decision? Not so good, Jim. Oh. So what you're telling me is that you're a guy that has less power than is required to manage your own decision to never take another drink. That's what you're looking at. That's good to know. I'd never anybody tell me to put it like that before. I'm just a guy with less power than is required to manage my own decision to never take another drink. These folks talked about it all weekend. That means, in short, I'm screwed, right? But the rest of these deals, you know, is all about finding and interacting with that power that allows me to do that quite easily, actually almost fairly effortless if I'm willing to do a few other simple things. And he told me, I'd already come to believe in a power called Alcoholics Anonymous. It's why I come here. He said, you'd be somewhere else if you didn't believe in Alcoholics Anonymous. Why are you here? Why are you here? Why are you here? I don't know, unless it's different in Oregon, the court system doesn't sentence you to weekend AA conferences. You know, they might make you go to the meetings, but they don't send you to weekend conferences. What are you doing here? He said, how come you're not at one more wind-up joint? You love going to those places. You know, the detox, the rehabs, the psych wards, the psychiatrists, places where alcoholics wind up. That's what they, you know. And he's like, you love going. Why aren't you back in one of those? And the truth was that somewhere deep down inside, although I couldn't articulate it and I didn't even know it on a visceral level, was something inside of me knew that something inside of you had an answer for me, and it was right here with you. And when I was with you, I was going to be okay. And that's why I was here, and that's why I kept coming back to you. I'd come to believe in a wonderful power called Alcoholics Anonymous, and that somehow through you and with you I was going to be okay, and that is exactly what happened. And our book says that's a wonderful starting place. Step three, if that was true, he said, if you believe AA is going to work for you, would you like to give it a try? Alcoholics Anonymous is the name of a book that you've never read with a program you've never tried. Would you like to actually do that? Those meetings are meetings. They're great, but they're meetings. You ought to try this program thing. Really good. And that seemed kind of brainless. Well, of course. And we started through that inventory process and the fears and the resentments and, gosh, my behavior over and over and over again and spotting those greater. And I believe that first trip through our program, it's just like triage, you know. It's like going into the emergency room. It doesn't have to be perfect. You're not reading a document that anybody in the world cares about except for you and your God, you know. And I got something on paper. I made a start. And I did the best that I could. And, you know, the idea was to stop the bleeding so that I could just make it another day without drinking. And it says that, you know, this first trip, what we've spotted are some of the greater, you know, flaws in our makeup. I got the rest of my life to work on the, you know, minutiae. Shoot, it's why I got married. She helps me every day. And we get to steps 8 and 9. And by this point, I'd moved on with a man named Roger McMahon. And Roger would be very upset if I didn't tell you his name. He's got a pacemaker. He's in Bethany Beach, Delaware. And if he's in the hospital, he thinks it's very important that you guys come to visit him and know his name and how you can find him. Because if I told you Roger M., you might not be able to get in. And he said, kid, this is where the rubber meets the road. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous up to step 9 is largely theoretical. All you are up till step 9 is a self-informed asshole. That's it. Nobody cares that you've made some peace with this power, whatever you think it is, and it's going on in the universe. Nobody cares that you've done steps 1, 2, 3. Nobody cares that you've done a bunch of inventory. Nobody could care less. You could tell us all about, you know, what your assets and defects are, what your shortcomings are. Nobody cares. Nobody cares that you got a list of what you're going to do or thinking about doing. In Alcoholics Anonymous, he said, we care about what you do. In other words, another way of saying that, my tombstone's not going to say, here lies Rich Bruckner, he meant well. Right? Because I always meant well. I don't know about any of you folks. When I left the house on a Friday night and took that shower, sprayed on a little bit of that girl sauce going out on the town in La Jolla to do a little nice drinking, and you said, what are you up to tonight? The answer was, you know what I'm going to do tonight? Tonight's the night I'm going to go out and I'm going to discuss my mother where her head drops to her feet and she can't look me in the eye for the next 5, 10 years. You got any plans tonight? Never left the house like that. Saturday night, what are you doing tonight? Oh, tonight's the night I'm going to shame my little sister to where she doesn't speak to me for the next 6 years. What are you up to tonight? Never my intentions, but it's what happened. Those are the results of my drinking. He said, you need to start dating your mother. Once a week, whatever's going on. I got my first little AA job. I'm working for a longtime sober guy in a picture frame shop. He carves hand-carved wooden picture frames. And my job's just to sweep the floor for $6.25 and keep that sawdust off the floor. And that $6.25, man, I had a little bit of money left at the end of the week. Always a dollar for the basket and always a little something to take my mom out on a date, whether it was to lunch or to dinner. A little becomes a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous right from the beginning. When my focus started to shift and I didn't even know it was happening to the spiritual, the material always took care of itself. A little became a lot almost immediately as soon as my focus shifted. And it's one of the just magic pieces of this deal. I'd had it all backwards all along. As long as I'm focused over here, it never gets right. But when I'm over here, it always takes care of itself. And I'm dating my mom, 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 and I'm going to these meetings, and the meetings I'm starting to go to, I'm starting to like the weird meetings, you know, with this thing up front, and I'm starting to like you people that are talking about steps, and I'm starting to, you know, huddle up next to those old guys smiling with that book, and the people, you have ever had that experience? Like, you start to like the meetings you didn't, and some of the people in there you thought were weird are becoming cool, and I mean, things are changing, and I'm not sure, it's kind of getting exciting, and I'm starting to smile a little bit, and this job, we're listening to these AA tapes of just all day long, man, I can't get enough of it, I just can't get enough, I feel safe when I'm with you, and this dating, mom, I mean, what's lamer, but I'm starting to like it, I mean, something's really happening, and one night at dinner, her eyes come up from her plate of food and she's looking at me square in the eye. And we're talking mother to son, son to mother, the way that it's supposed to be. when she calls, she's getting a little older. She can't get on a chair to get up and change her light bulbs. Used to take me 2 to 3 weeks to get over there to get sober enough to, you know, show up to change a light bulb. Not anymore. Taking out the trash. Little things, nothing spectacular, things sons do. But those are big deals for an alcoholic of my variety. That my mom knows in the core of her being that when she calls me, her son's going to be there. And that's what's going on. My wife and I have been blessed in this program that we've had some just great, great events. I mean, as we all have. One of those was we were in a position for a guy that couldn't have a bank account. It turns out, pay attention to this if you're new. When you pay your bills, you get good credit. And when we did that, that meant I qualified for a mortgage at like the best possible rate. And I didn't plan for any of that to happen. You all just said, whatever date's on that bill, send the money by that date. And that's what I focused on. And it turns out when you're sending that money by that date, what's happening over here is that your credit's getting better. And that baffled me for like 20 years of my life. And I didn't really even want that to happen. I couldn't have told you that's what I was doing when I was just paying bills, but that's how it worked out. And because of that, we just got to buy this spectacular home on the water, looking out at the Chesapeake Bay, over the island of Ocean City, and out towards the ocean. And the best part about that house is it's 1.5 miles from my mom's house. And when she needs a light bulb changed, I'm there, buddy. I had a set of Baltimore Ravens season tickets when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know why. I had a black hefty trash bag full of all my other possessions and a set of, you know how that is. We got nothing we need and things we don't when we get here. I think they might have been a trade for like that last drug deal that you do to get yourself set up for sobriety. I don't know. But I got these things and he says, send those to your little sister. She lives in Baltimore. You live 3 hours away. You don't even like the NFL now that you're sober. What you liked about going to the games was getting drunk in the parking lot, having a big tailgate, being the big shot, cutting a prime rib, having the best bar in the parking lot. By the time the game started, you never even knew who won anyways. You know, and he was right. But I tried to explain to him, these are expensive, that's stupid, she hasn't talked to me in 6.5 years. And he said, I don't care, send the tickets. And I did, and nothing happened. He said, send the next set. I said, wait a second. You know, I did this once, that would... Shut up and send the tickets. And I did. And the phone rang. That Sunday in the afternoon, on the other end of that phone, there was this little voice. Richie, did you see that? They just threw the ball into the end zone. They tied up the game. I don't know who they were playing. I don't know what the score was. I couldn't have cared about anything less. But, man, I was talking to my little sister for the first time in 6.5 years. And I kept sending those tickets, and she kept calling, and we started to build this relationship around football. She just kind of report in, and all week long, you know, I do my little job, and then I got this tremendous, tremendous raise in AA. I got my second sober job, and that was vacuuming swimming pools. And I got $500 a week, man. I'm sending money to the IRS. I owed them $47,000, and I'm sending $20, and I'm not sure why I'm doing that, but my sponsor said that's what we do, and I'm trying to explain to him that you cannot ever pay off $47,000. I'm going to pay them when I get it all together. That's my plan, and anybody knows that plan, right? I'm going to. When I get it all, he goes, well, you're never going to. You know? And that's the thing with the ninth step. If you're waiting for when it's convenient, easier, you got it all together, you're never going to do it. And so here we go, and I'm sending this, you know, little bit of money of my $500. I'm putting $1 in the basket. I'm starting to like the meetings. I'm dating my mother. I mean, this sounds lame, and I'm getting excited. And now on the weekends, I'm driving to my little sister's house to help her paint the walls in her new little townhouse she bought, help her get things set up, and I'm becoming a brother. And my shoulders are going back without me knowing it, and my head's starting to come up, and I'm starting to not be a shoe looker, you know. I'm starting to be able to look at y'all. Turns out that self-esteem starts to follow esteemable actions. I didn't know that. And what happens is after years of this going on with my little sister, one day I get a phone call from a guy, I know him, he says, this is Justin, Rich. I'm calling because your father is no longer a part of your lives, but you're a big, big part of your little sister's life. You're the number one man in her life, and I'm calling to ask you if I could have her hand in marriage. And I can tell you that there is nothing that a drunk of my variety is less qualified to do than to give away the hand of a beautiful little girl like that. what came out of my mouth was, "You do any drinking?" You know, I had to mess with him a little bit. And he told me all he wanted to do was love her and make her happy. And I said, "That sounds good by me." And she called the next day and asked if I'd walk her down the aisle. I got to do that, a sober man in my right mind, you know, and dressed the way I was supposed to and on time and all the things that y'all teach me each week in the meetings. I had this little friend, Ethan. He'd been my friend since third grade. He's my oldest friend in the world. He invited me to be the best man in his wedding. His father sent me a plane ticket. This is, I'm living out in San Diego in La Jolla, taking over the world, one drug deal at a time. And his father has me fit it for a tuxedo, buys it, sends me a plane ticket so that I could be the best man in his wedding. And I'm too drunk to get on the plane, and I don't show up. I don't call, and I don't show. And when you do something like that, and you're like me, which is, you know, I've already told you, the cat's out of the bag. I'm a coward that tries to hide behind the guise of a tough guy. Tough guys show up and they walk through troubles. Guys like me don't do that. You go on an invisible list. When I do something like that to you, you go on this list that I keep deep in my belly of the people that I can't answer their phone call. You know, when we get here, most alcoholics, newcomers, I guarantee those folks with 4 days sober that raised their hand, and I am so happy you're here and a part of this great thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, because I've never seen another place where you get to be a part of such a great miracle. And everything that happens here is all good all the time. Don't be scared of anything. There's nothing here that can hurt you. But what happens when we're new like that? We don't have anything. I don't have a home, a family yet back in my... I got nothing, but boy, do I have caller ID, right? They all got the newest cell phone, you know, that I can't afford with the caller ID. And it's because you got to look at that, you know, before you answer the phone when you're new. It's very important to see who's calling, because there's a whole lot of people that you can't answer the phone for a whole lot of reasons. And I was, you know, I had a long list. And Ethan was on that list because I knew why he was calling. He was calling to tell me what a no-good drunk bum I was. You didn't show up at the wedding. You screwed my father. My wife hates you. I'd heard he had a little daughter. I knew she hated me because he told him. And then I heard he had a little boy. And the more I'm hearing, the sicker I get. And my guts are getting tighter. And whenever the phone rings and I see it's his number, I can't answer it. And I get that sick feeling. And this goes on. He says, "Ethan's next on the list, buddy. You got to make the approach." And I called and I asked if I could have 5-10 minutes of his, maybe his father's time on a Saturday or a Sunday on a weekend. And I'm a thing in that part of this thing, Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got to try to make this thing right. I said, "I know, you know, that what I did was lousy, man, and I'm a lousy friend. Can I please just have 5-10 minutes of your time? This is like a life or death errand." And he said, "Yeah, you could be here this Saturday at 7 a.m. if you can make it." And this is about 9 years later, so he remembered. I think he might have had one of those resentment things. But the inventory was ours, not the other man. So I get to show up. I'm 15 minutes early because in AA, I mean, my sponsor taught me at my home group, if you're a half hour early, you're late. Turns out that's a wonderful principle for life. They like when I do that at work, too, it turns out. I've gotten lots of promotions off of just that little technique. You know, I'm going to be on time, in fact, early. So I get there, and I see his dad's car in the driveway, and he's home, and I knock on the door, and I got a pocket full of money from doing the swimming pools. And he opens the door, and his wife's standing by the center island, and I heard she was beautiful, and she was. And that little girl is standing next to her holding her hand. And what I didn't see is out of nowhere, man, some little boy just came darting at me from another room, and he runs up to me and he grabbed a hold of my leg like a tree trunk, and he looked up in my eyes and he said, "You're my Uncle Rich. Daddy said one day I'd meet you." And our book on page 78 says that 9 out of 10 times when the approach is made in this fashion, the unexpected happens. And in that instant, I had a knowing. It wasn't anything you guys taught me or convinced me of. Bill Wilson says, and I think it's very significant about our spirituality, the spirituality of AA, if there's such a thing, that, you know, at long last, I saw, I felt, I believed. That first I saw it, and then I began to feel it. And then I developed a belief. You guys didn't sell me anything. You didn't convince me of anything. In that instant, with that kid holding my legs and looking up at me and saying what he said to me, I just somehow knew that I am what separates me from you. Those blinders fell from my eyes. I am the thing that separates me from you. My inability to admit my mistakes, my stupid ego, my stupid inability to just look you in the eye and tell you what happened. To say those words, "I'm sorry, and how can I make this right? And I've screwed up again and again and again." And in doing that, I get free. And it's funny how you can learn this in about a nanosecond. It's just some kind of inner knowing with the little kid looking up in your eyes that I'm what separated me from him. The big trouble with that is when I'm separated from you, I'm separated from God. Since then, I've gotten to show up. I've gotten to their birthdays, Christmas Eve. My wife and I go there. We do my family. Then we do his family. And I show up with gifts for those little kids. Their birthdays. If it snows, I try to get down there to take them sleigh ride. I mean, it's 3 hours each way. And you know what those little guys and girls say? They look at me because they're just kids. And they go, Uncle Rich, you show up on all the good days. Like it's an accident. And I got to sit down in the other room, you know, with his father and make my amends to his father. And I said, I think I owe you some money for a plane ticket and a tuxedo. And, you know, and I go through the whole amends. And he said, you're right, you do. You owe me $1,372. And I didn't see that coming, but I had it. And I start to pull it out of my pocket and to give it to him. And he says, no. If you're really a part of this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, you really have a home group, you really are doing all this stuff you're talking about, what you're going to do is no more than $10 at a time, you're going to take cookies, donuts, something to that group. You're going to save the receipt. No more than 10 bucks can any one receipt be for. You're going to put gas in a newcomer's car so that they can get to the next meeting. Don't give them the money. Put the gas in their car. Save the receipt. When you get $1,370 worth of $10 receipts for all things spent on your home group or another alcoholic, you bring them to me. On that day, your amends to me will be complete. By the way, Rich, I'm 28 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been praying for you and Eighth since you've been about that big. And I can tell you that my home group, if there were some members here to report, they would tell you that they happily ate Stouffer's lasagna for about 3 years. They're $9.95 a tray. I would cook them at 425 degrees for an hour and 15 minutes before. And I got it down. And the last thing with, we're down to the bottom of this list, and I still had some things were looking pretty great in my life. My mother and I was dating, you know, you guys, by this point, you let me re-enter the dating world and threw in the complimentary AA girlfriend that we get somewhere along the way, I suppose. And I had one last warrant in San Diego, and I'd been pulled over for drunk driving. I had some of the white stuff, the outside issues or whatever in my pocket, and the stuff I do when I'm drinking. And I went in front of a judge out there, and I told that judge what I tell every judge, which he said, you know, we're going to put you on this thing called the PC 1000 program. It's a first-time felony offenders program that if you complete this type of probation that includes 10 meetings of AA, see this counselor, some urine tests, you know, jump through these hoops, this will go away. You will not have a conviction on your record. And we let, you're a young man. We don't want to strap you down with, you know, another felony at this age. And I said what I say to all judges. I'll absolutely, thank you, Your Honor. I will be your model guy. And I believe that. You know, if you hook me up to a lie detector, that's what I'm going to do. And I believe it. I have no idea that the choice is not mine, that I have lost power, choice, and control. I think it's actually up to me whether I'm going to do these things. And then I don't do them. And then when I don't do them, I've already told you, my solutions to problems are way worse than the problems. I run. So then the warrant, you know, magnifies. It gets bad. And the judge said, if you don't finish this, I'm going to give you every day of the 5 years. Are we clear? And I said, oh, yes, Your Honor. And so here we are, you know, about 10 years later, and he says it's time for you to go serve that 5 years in California. And this is a great time, as a matter of fact, for you to go serve that 5 years in California. And sponsors see things different. I mean, I did not see it like that. I'm like, what are you talking about? My mother needs me, my sister, you know, I'm fixing up that house down there. My girlfriend needs me. We got this house together. And you know, my career. And he said, whoa, let me help you see this. This is a wonderful time. First of all, just go talk to your mother and see what she would have you do. All your mother's ever wanted was for you to do the right thing. See what she says. This girlfriend that you have, she's 18 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. She's been sober a long time before you ever got here. She's got a sponsor and a God of her own. She'll be just fine without you, maybe better. This career you think you have, you vacuum swimming pools. Just about anyone could do that. They'll be fine. And this house you think you have, it's not a house. It's a trailer, and you don't own it. You rent it. And I'm like, ugh. And they see things different. He said, this is a really good time for you to do that 5 years. And a couple of the guys from the home group, my sponsor, they drove me to the airport, and I was a hot mess. I was sweating under my arms. I was sick. You know, that morning I went in and out of the bathroom in the courthouse 3 times. Any of this business about faith and fear cannot be in the same place at the same time. I haven't experienced that. I was scared to death and somehow thought that with you, through you, and this power, I was going to make out all right. And that didn't mean I wasn't scared, because I was. And I went in front of that judge, and what I didn't know, 47 of you folks wrote that guy a letter, telling him what my life looked like and how many meetings I was going to and who I was helping and what floors I was mopping. And I was mopping floors in churches that didn't even have AA just to put something back into the community. And just a picture of my life. Y'all took the time to do that for me and to send it out there. And he couldn't even believe that I was standing in front of him, that I just flew 3,000 miles on my own nickel. And he said, what do you have to say for yourself? I said, I don't ever want to have to drink, man. I don't ever want to have to drink. And I'll do whatever you want me to do. And he said, well, they say that you've done it. I ordered you to 10 meetings. They say you've been to over 1,000. They this, that, and the other thing. He goes down the list. He said, you didn't do this my way, Mr. Bruckner, but you did do it. This case is dismissed. And I walked out in the hallway, and I couldn't believe it, because if I pulled my NCIC for you folks right now, you'd see 36 arrests. I've never gotten a break. I'm not a prison guy, I'm not a tough guy, but I am a guy that gets, you know, 30 to 60 days in the county lockup every single time. And I can't believe this was the first, and I called Roger, you know, I said, Roger, tell the guys from the men's group, I'm coming home, they're not locking me up, tell them I'm coming home, and I'm all fired up. And he says, whoa, wait a second, hotshot, you can't get a plane ticket home until tomorrow, right? It's the afternoon. And I said, yeah, why? He said, well, what about that college, you know, those Jesuits that kicked you out, aren't they right near there? Why don't you go straighten that out? And I'm thinking, give me a break. Like, can we have a moment of celebration? You know, but our book talks about action and more action, right? Little lasting results unless followed by more vigorous action. And this guy's relentless. They're like that, these sponsors. So I drive over to that University of San Diego, and wouldn't you know it, the same dean's the dean all those years later. And I said, I don't know if you remember me. My name's Rich Bruckner. I used to go to college here. You all kicked me out. I had some problems. She just stopped me and looked at me. She says, Rich, we remember you. We've only had one student go to the federal penitentiary and be in the newspaper. And I told her what I was a part of and what I was there to do. And I said, I now know, you know, what I did was I brought a great deal of shame to this institution. And I brought a great deal of shame to what this institution stands for and it being in the paper like that. And I now know, while I didn't when I went here, I now know what the Jesuits stand for, building men of integrity and education and doing the right thing, a whole bunch of stuff that I didn't stand for. And I don't have any idea how to make this right, but I'll do whatever you tell me. And that dean walked me next door to a building I'd never been in and put a big stack of paper in front of me and said, I want you to fill this out. This is an application to our law school. If you're serious, what you're going to do is you're going to go here. You're going to graduate. And then you're going to make us proud. That's how you can make this right. We don't like to kick people out. We like people to graduate. That's actually what makes a school look good, is having a high graduation rate. And I step outside and I call Roger and I say that this dean, I said, she'd lost her mind. They want me to go to law school with a big stack of paper. I vacuum swimming pools. I barely got through college, blah, 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 blah. Even if I did get through law school, they'd never let me take the bar exam with my criminal record. If I did happen to take the bar exam and pass, they'd never let me pass the ethics committee. And if I made it past the ethics committee, blah, blah. He's, shut up. Shut up. Did you just tell her that you would do whatever she said to make it right? I said, yes, I did. He said, then shut up and fill out the papers. And I did. And 3 years later, man, I graduated second from the top in my class. And not because of anything I did, but because of what you guys did. You taught me to get there early for each class, shake each teacher's hand every single day until they learned my name and I knew theirs. Stay after class, ask a question, whether you have one or not. It's just like we do with the newcomers after the meeting. Worked wonderful. And I came back and my phone rang. I mean, I wasn't out of law school for 6 months, you know, get these bar results back. And I mean, there were some interesting things. You know, I did have to go in front of the ethics committee. And And they said, gosh, you have these wonderful grades or these great, you know, references, because it was you folks writing them for me. And they said, but then we look over here and you have this criminal record, these 36. We just can't put two and two together. What's going on? And a lot of lawyers and judges on that committee, I said, well, your honors and members of the committee, I said, I've had to disclose to you that I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not sure what your familiarity is with Alcoholics Anonymous. You may or may not know that there's a substantial period of drinking required for membership. And they laugh like you guys did. And I said, you're looking at me sober and me drunk, and if I take a drink, I'll be self-eliminating. You all won't have to worry about me. And the next thing you know, I get a phone call, and on the other end of that phone is some guy I've never talked to, and thank God I can answer the phone for strange numbers. There's many of you in this room that are my friends this weekend. That's another thing that's been very special. I know a lot of you. And you know that when you call me, how I answer the phone today. Hello, Rich Bruckner. And it doesn't matter who's on the other end of the phone. And thank God. Because on that day, when that weird number called, on the other end was some guy who introduced himself. He said he was the state's attorney for the state of Maryland. And they'd been given my name by somebody else from the governor's office, and that they just received a large federal grant, and he wanted to hire an assistant state's attorney to head up the gang and narcotics prosecution unit for the state of Maryland. Would I serve as the assistant state's attorney for the state of Maryland? And he'd given my number, he said, because he was told that I might know something about the importation of narcotics. And you know, the first thought that went through my mind once my jaw came up off the ground was, they never lied to me. They never lied to me. Those old guys with that smile on their face and that book in their hand, and they said, hey, kid, one day your sordid past will become your greatest asset. They never lied to me. And there are days when I stand there, and I've served the state of Maryland in that capacity for the last 6 years. And it was tough. At first, these judges, they say things to just trick you. And he would say, in the morning I'd go and he'd say, would the defendant please rise? I'd stand up and they'd go, no. And I'd turn red and I'd get all sweaty because, I mean, it's tricky. And I got the hang of it. I stayed down now for that part. And I'll tell you what happens when I look across. I happen to believe with every core of my being that I am uniquely situated to stand at that table on that day at that time and to look across at that defendant, and somebody else in my role might see an armed robber. I see a guy that needed a drink at 3 o'clock in the morning when the morning terror and madness were on, would steal from his wife's slender purse like I stole from my mother's. I see a guy that maybe, just maybe, has what I have that somebody else might not get to recognize. And I can tell you, in 6 years, I've come up with some very creative sentencing arrangements. And each day, what has happened is there is now no such thing as my work life, my family life, my marriage life, my AA life. I don't have to keep anybody separate. It's all one deal. A life of service with you, through you, and together with you. I get to have just one life. Conscious connection. And each day, I say two incredible things, every single day almost. In the morning, I walk into that courtroom and I get to stand up with a little bit of dignity and my head up, my shoulders back, and I say, good morning, Your Honor, Rich Bruckner for the state of Maryland. And each night, I get to say the far more important thing, somewhere like this with folks like you. I get to say that my name's Rich Bruckner. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks for my life.